You're listening to People of Interest on CKUW 95.9 FM, University of Winnipeg Radio. My name is Jeffrey Young, and we're joined in the studio by Eve Engler. Eve, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
To save me the work, can you give the good people a brief explanation of who you are?
I'm a Montreal-based activist and author of four books, most recent ones, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy and Canada and Israel Building Apartheid.
I'm hoping we can kind of divide this into three sort of sections. In the first section, an overview. In the second section, discuss Haiti a bit. And then in the third, discuss Israel particularly. You've been very, you were very critical of Canadian foreign policy a lot around the time that we were denied seat on Security Council. And our foreign policy has kind of evolved in the Stephen Harper period. What do you think were the reasons that Canada did not get a seat on the Security Council?
Well, the simple reason is that they pissed off too much of the world, and I think that they really oriented their foreign policy to the extreme sectors of their base, the Christian evangelicals, the Zionists, the Jewish right-wing Jews, the mining executives, the military-industrial complex types, and the old cold warriors, and that the manifestation of those policies was everything from claiming that Russia was being aggressive to supporting Israel no matter what, making all kinds of hostile comments to the elected government in Venezuela and giving sort of tacit support to the coup in Honduras in June of 2009. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, countries around the world were hostile to this mm-hmm. policy. And despite having all the advantages against Portugal in the attempt to get a seat mm-hmm. on the Security Council back in October, Canada lost. The Harper government spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in lobbying campaigns to buy maple syrup for all the UN mm-hmm. diplomats and stuff like that, and lost, I think, because ultimately the policy that they were pursuing is really offside with world opinion.
What are the mechanisms behind this foreign policy? Because it seems in certain instances, such as the pressure on Venezuela, for example, that our national interest in doing that is not precisely clear. Our national interest in tacitly supporting the coup in Honduras last year, being that it was undemocratic, once again, it's not really clear what our national interest is. So how has this, as our national interest, been determined?
Well, I think that the idea of just a sort of national interest is in of itself mistaken. The idea that the CEO of a large mining firm has the same interests in foreign policy as a janitor is mm-hmm. incorrect. Unfortunately, the foreign policy is largely being designed by the CEO of the banking company or the military company, rather than the majority of working Canadians or ordinary Canadians. In the case of Venezuela, talk about things very concrete. In the case of Venezuela, there's a number of Canadian mining companies that have had their assets, their concessions nationalized by the Chavez government as part of a breaking away from capitalism and North American domination, mm-hmm. and that's created some hostility among some of the most important, most influential mining executives. Someone like Peter Munk, the former head of Barrick Gold,
yep.
Has made viciously hostile comments to the elected government in Venezuela, mm-hmm. And he sees that even though his company actually hasn't had assets taken by or rescinded by the Chavez government, he sees the shift of policy that the Venezuelan government is pursuing as a threat to his company's interests around the region mm-hmm. and even around the world. Mm-hmm. I think the Canadian capitalism is heavily based Today, around the mining companies are a big part of it, and those companies are dependent upon extreme free market capitalist policy. They need one of the first things that governments do when they move away from neoliberal capitalism is they tend to increase the royalty rates that mining companies pay, tend to nationalize resources, and you know, Canada's base of 60% of the world's mining money and companies, and they're very hostile to those sort of shifts. So there is very particular Canadian corporate interests that you know oppose the shift in Latin America, and you see some of that also in the case of the coup in Honduras.
Many of these transnational corporations, by their very definition, tend to be transnational. So can you say that this foreign policy is being come to as a result of primarily of pressures that are outside of Canada, or do you think it is domestic pressures that is leading to this foreign policy? Basically, to what level are we autonomous of the United States making these decisions?
Yeah, I actually think that they're overwhelmingly it's autonomous. I don't conceive of Canadian foreign policy as being bullied by Ottawa, being bullied by Washington, and that in fact that happens, you know, on occasion, but mostly it's about the Canadian elite seeing the world and profiting from the world in a very similar way to the U.S. elite, and so they're willing partners in U.S. empire, and in the case of the mining companies. Particularly, you know, the idea that, you know, Washington has forced Barrick Gold into exploiting Papua New Guinea's is, you know, it's absurd. Barrick Gold has very particular, you know, profit-oriented reasons for displacing people and you know, whatnot.
How does the kind of blue helmet image of Peacekeeping Canada play into these corporations' behaviors?
Well, sometimes, you know, you have to. I don't think that the actual the corporations, the mythology of Canada as a benevolent force, I don't think it has much effect on. They act in the exact same way that a American company does, that a British company does. You know, it's based on bottom line.
But it seems to, in a lot of ways, help Canadian companies, except for a couple. Barrick is a good example. It kind of. Or does it help provide sort of a level of protection from that criticism, in that they're not sort of seen as big nasty Uncle Sam because they're just not American?
Yeah, I mean, I think that exists to some extent. I think it certainly exists in Canada. So, for instance, one example that comes to mind is Garda World, which is a Montreal-based private security company that does a lot of, I don't know if here in Winnipeg, but in Montreal has a lot of the Garda trucks that, you know, fill the ATM machines. But they had four or five of their employees kidnapped in Iraq. They were, you know, part of them. They were, you know, effectively a mercenary company in Iraq. In 2007, they had a number of their employees kidnapped, and the front page of the Ottawa Citizen, I don't remember the exact title, but something to the effect of how is a good Canadian company involved in security services in Iraq? Like, very much this, like, the idea, you know, sort of this really contravenes the idea of Canada as a benevolent international force, and also it the implication was that, you know, these people who had kidnapped the Garda employees, that they were, you know, mistaken, you know, they didn't know they were Canadians. How, you know, how did they, you know, not understand the difference between a, you know, Canadian mercenary and an American mercenary? So there is some of that, and I think there is some of that in countries where, yes, you know, there's the idea of an ugly American is a sort of more deeply rooted, particularly in Latin America, of you know, American corporations. But there's also today, as I understand it, like in some of the Central American countries, in Guatemala specifically, where people actually see it as being preferable to have a U.S. A flag on your backpack if you're, you know, traveling through there, than a Canadian one, because there are so many Canadian corporations involved in terribly destructive
Of Peru as well.
Yeah. And conflicts, and so in fact the Canadian corporations are increasingly being seen as, you know, more common than the, you know, the ugly Canadian being sort of more common than the ugly American in that sense.
Yeah. So could you say therefore that this spot on the Security Council didn't come because, in a lot of ways, the international view of our foreign policy is somewhat more accurate than the domestic view of our foreign policy.
For sure, for sure. And I think that that's one of the reasons why this is very significant. We should look at the Harper losing the seat on the Security Council as a big victory. People who believe in internationalism and who believe in, you know, changing the power imbalances in the world should see the loss as a big a victory. And it was, I think, for a lot of Canadians, a sort of jolt from their self-perception about Canada's role in the world, and the mythology of Canada as just a benevolent do-gooder is a real obstacle to a yeah. more just foreign policy. So in that sense, it was the victory was important, and I think opened a lot of people's eyes and increased willingness to be critical of Canadian foreign policy.
One of the kind of primary, we're going to say, like noticeable points, particularly in this last round of Stephen Harper, has been Canada's support for Israel. I know Al Jazeera has been covering that at length. Ran a half an hour special on that fact. How has our policy towards Israel changed in the past 10 years?
Well, there was a shift. The Paul Martin government shifted towards a stronger pro-Israel policy than the Chrétien government. Mm-hmm. And the Chrétien government, we shouldn't think of this as being the Chrétien government as being like an honest broker. Yeah. It was still very oriented yeah. towards Israel. In my opinion, unjustly, in that the Palestinians are the side that have been dispossessed and have been oppressed. But Paul Martin moved more towards a stronger pro-Israel position, voting against some resolutions at the UN. That the Chrétien government had been critical of Israel, that the Chrétien government had been prepared to support resolutions that the vast majority of the world supports. But the Harper government has taken that a whole step further and really deepened that and basically had a policy of Israel no matter what. And just a complete unwillingness to criticize, despite the fact that this is at a time when Israel, launched a brutal invasion of Lebanon in 2006, yep. launched a terribly destructive 22-day bombing campaign against mm-hmm. Gaza 2 years ago, and continues to usurp Palestinian land against international law. And so concretely, what Harper's policy did is a very important role diplomatically, and I think arguably the most pro-Israel country, turned Canada into the most pro-Israel country in the world diplomatically. But there's also some very concrete shifts. So it made it easier for Canadian charities to give money that tax subsidized by the taxpayer to Israeli organizations involved in settlements in the occupied territories, which ostensibly contravene international law, has supported this building of a Palestinian security force in the West Bank to combat the rise of Hamas and to really sort of oversee Israel's occupation in the West Bank. So there's millions of dollars of Canadian, tens of millions of dollars of Canadian aid money going to this security reform that's really designed to serve Israel's interests in the West Bank. So it's really on the level of military ties between Canadian and the Israeli military is really deepened. Just last week, Peter McKay, Canada's defense minister, was in Israel, and in part of the press release that was sent out said something to the effect of Israel has really been helping Canada for Canada's role in Afghanistan, helping the Canadian military in Afghanistan. So Israel has sort of perfected the Israeli army and the military companies have perfected some of the technologies and methods in terms of controlling the Palestinian population and in terms of warfare that the Canadian military is now putting to use in Afghanistan. And mm-hmm. the Canadian military is thankful to the Israeli military for the help in terms of the drones that Israel sells to Canada and yeah. the different sort of military methods.
Do we as a nation play any role in the tensions between Iran and Israel over that nuclear program?
Yeah, for sure. The Harper government, going back a few years ago, there was the CanWest reporter based in UN in New York talked about how there was a plan to sort of divide the work between the major Western powers vis-a-vis Iran, and that Canada's main role in that division of labor was to really go after Iran's human rights record and try to really just campaign of demonizing Iran. And a lot of it is legitimate. There's lots of very legitimate criticisms of the Iranian regime. regime. But at the same time, we talk about, you know, women's rights in Iran. There's little talk about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, which is actually more repressive.
Or on the Grassy Narrows Reserve.
Or in the Grassy Narrows Reserve, or here in Canada, or, you know, different, you know. And actually, interestingly enough, the Iran's response to Canada's constant diplomatic condemnation is actually to talk about murdered and missing indigenous women in Canada, for instance, right? Iran has
a very big local issue here, yeah.
Yeah, so Iran has, as you know, and I mean, and there's, just as there's legitimate criticisms of the Iranian regime, there's legitimate criticisms of human rights record within Canada. So I mean, I think on both sides, it's actually, you know, it's designed for their own geopolitical reasons, and it's not, you know, the human interest that the issues represent is not what's motivating it from either from the Harper government or from the Iranian government. But the Harper government has really participated in this destabilization campaign. There's Canadian, obviously thousands of Canadian troops that occupy a country bordering Iran. There's Canadian naval vessels patrolling off the coast of Iran, running provocative maneuvers. And this sort of campaign against Iran is all under the guise that Iran is possibly building nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Well, you know, anyone who cares about peace and doesn't, you know, believes in the environment doesn't obviously want any more nuclear weapons to be built.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're critical of Iran's nuclear weapons or possible nuclear weapon program. Israel's known nuclear stockpile is
giant.
Giant and is okay. And so the Harper government has actually just back in September, Bloomberg News cited Canada as one of three countries that blocked an Arab attempt to have a nuclear-free Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And the Harper government has abstained on a number of international Atomic Energy Agency resolutions calling for Israel's known nuclear stockpile to be put under International Atomic Energy Agency constraints. And that's obviously resolutions that the vast majority of the world supports. So there really is a quite noticeable hypocrisy on that issue. And Harper is preparing the way for a possible U.S.-Israeli attack against Iran.
Mm-hmm. In the United States, there's a lot of talk about, quote, the Jewish lobby and the Israel lobby and its effect on the policy that when kind of further investigated can prove somewhat erroneous, particularly the automatic kind of the piece of it. It seems to be almost automatic information that all American Jews support Israel, that all American Jews do not support a Palestinian state. And then when these things have been pulled out, when they've been investigated, it's been largely found to be untrue. Is there such a lobby in Canada, either existent or conspiracy existent? And how does that dynamic of Canadian Jewishness play into support for Israel in Canada?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the first thing. I'm of the opinion that there's an exaggeration of the clout of a pro-Israel Jewish lobby in Canada or in the U.S. for that matter. And the first reason for that is that there's actually a lot of Canadian Jews who are not supportive of either Israel's occupation policy or even of Zionism more generally.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's the first thing. But my reading of things is that the pro-Israel Jewish lobby is really pushing against an open door, and the establishment, the foreign policy establishment, is pro-Zionist historically and pro-Israel today. Primarily because they've seen it as an outpost of Western imperialism in the Middle East, as, you know, other sort of Christian Zionist reasons and some other reasons, but that primarily, and so the pro-Israel Jewish lobby really gets, you know, is in a very fertile context in which they're lobbying, but the other part that sort of the people who tend to focus on just a simple pro-Israel Jewish lobby, they deny the history of what Canadian foreign policy represents, or not even just history, but even the today of Canadian foreign policy, and that In fact, it's pro-corporate, pro-empire oriented everywhere in the world, not just in the case of Palestinian rights. And it's sort of implied is that if it wasn't for this powerful Jewish lobby, then Canada would just do the right thing, just because that's what Canada wants to do. But this, yeah. you know, pro-Israel. And so that to me is really a problematic formulation, because that's not my reading of Canadian foreign policy. You know, from Haiti to Afghanistan yeah. To you know, the Congo.
Since you mentioned it, we'll skip on to Haiti. Canada clearly has a lot of interests in Haiti. We're a huge presence there. Our embassy is as big as the American embassy. Our embassy is better placed than the American embassy. And we're really just as visible on the ground in the country as the United States, in an actual human sense, not in the America is everywhere sort of sense. What do you read as Canada's interest in Haiti, particularly after the earthquake, being?
Well, I think that the main interest of the Canadian government in Haiti since earthquake is more of the same, going back to particularly the 2004 coup, and what that represents is really the exclusion of the majority poor from political life, yeah. and seeing them actually as a threat and a danger. And that was the Harper government's response to the earthquake, was to send 2,000 troops, yeah. and not to send the heavy urban search and rescue teams that were prepared to be
actually
sent from,
needed, yeah.
Yeah, actually needed, you know. So it was really to militarize it, and that's all tied into this sort of security ideology or security sort of logic. And that, you know, Canada's put more than $50 million in mm-hmm. in so-called aid money to announce at least to Haitian policing in prison. So this is since the earthquake, and yeah. it, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars before the earthquake, since the coup before that. And it's tied into the ideology or the idea of really supporting the repressive apparatus of the Haitian state on behalf of the tiny Haitian elite.
11 families, yeah.
Yeah, the 11 families that, you know, that have traditionally run the place, and that who are intimately connected to Washington and Ottawa, yep. right? They're, you know, they work hand in glove with Washington and Ottawa, and they're usually the agents of a company like Guild and Active, where a Montreal-based t-shirt maker, second biggest employer at the time of the earthquake in Haiti after the Haitian state, you know, a sweatshop sort of company, and they do their operations sometimes subcontracted to Haitian elite. Andy Ped, an important political figure in Haiti,
and a known CIA operative director.
Yeah, yes, exactly, and involved
street knowledge there.
Yeah, back in the 1990 coup and the more recent coup, a very important role that family's played. And so that's, I think, the interests of the Canadian government in Haiti is to keep the population in check, mm-hmm. and to do so with the intent of having a big hub of cheap labor for either directly for Canadian companies or for their subcontractors. I think that's the main policy.
And what about the mineral wealth? It's okay. It's really sketchy in my mind how much mineral wealth and oil and natural gas exists, because in my 4 months in Haiti, enough resources was discovered in Haiti to buy the whole world 20 times over. It's just the nature of Haitians. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? We're sitting on the most oil. Mm-hmm. We have the most gold. Like, my God, are they ever rich. Do any of our corporations that you know of have stated interests in the mineral and hydrocarbon sectors in Haiti?
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical of to what extent there are mineral resources in Haiti, and like, to, you know, there obviously are mineral resources. The question, you know, the quantity. What we do know, according to the Northern Miner, one of the mining trade journals, is that KWG Resources, which I think it's Montreal based. It might not be Montreal, but it's a Canadian company, has prospecting rights for 10% of all Haitian territory.
Shale gas?
No, for, I think it's primarily for like copper and the like, mostly in the north. We also know that Saint-Geneviève Resources, that definitely a Montreal-based company, they had some conflict going back to the mid-1990s in terms of going forward with some of their their exploration. They had some peasants that were opposed to their projects again in the north, and Aristide, who actually wasn't even in office at the time, was seen to have sort of taken the side of the peasants. And there's a Toronto Star business section article from 2007, I believe, talks about how happy Saint-Geneviève was with the fact that there's, you know, Aristide's gone, and since the coup, there was the 2004 February 2004 coup against the elected government Haiti. Since that time, there's been improved prospects for their operations in
Haiti.
So there is definitely mineral mining companies in Canada that see Haiti as a future and current source of profits.
Yeah. How do our interests there differ from the American?
I think in the case of Haiti, the interests are pretty aligned. There is a history of sort of, I think, some sort of independent Canadian imperial activity in the Caribbean, particularly in the English-speaking Caribbean. I think in the case of Haiti, the Ottawa and Washington are pretty sort of see things similar. I'm sure there are conflicts between like Gild and Activewear, for instance, and American apparel companies. Yeah. You know that they're different intra-corporate activities. But I think on the level of government policy, they're pretty eye to eye.
How do our policy goals manifest themselves in our development programs there?
Well, I mean, the first, you know, the fact that the Canadian International Development Agency is, you know, spends so-called aid money in terms of building up the repressive apparatus of the Haitian state is an example where it's, you know, most Canadians, when they think of aid, they think of, you know, getting, you know, there's over a million people in, you know, tent camps still, and we're putting all this money into building the policing apparatus. So most people think of it as aid as being, you know, about water and food and sanitation and schooling and stuff like that. So that's, quite sort of troublesome. But more generally, I think that the question, I don't know if the question is leading to the role of government-funded non-governmental organizations in Haiti. And there's been a big problem with Canadian International Development Agency-funded NGOs, Canadian NGOs operating, mostly Quebec-based NGOs operating in Haiti in a way to undermine the democratic movement of the Famille Lavalas, the Haiti's elected government back in 2004, but also more generally undermine the capacity of the Haitian government to provide some of those social services that most Canadians believe the government should provide. So most Canadians believe that there should be a public education system. And CEDA has actually even admitted that their support for NGOs rather than the government has undermined the capacity of the Haitian state. Back in 2005, a CEDA report said that, you know, they admitted that they were, you know, doing that, or the effect of their policy was. And I think that was the intended effect by, you know, some of the Canadian decision makers.
Let alone the cultural impact of making Haiti into a recipient nation.
Yes, no, I mean, the whole premise of the sort of NGO kind of, I guess you could call it development model, that's probably a mistaken, is really we know what's best for those who are you know, implicitly inferior and incapable of running their own affairs. And actually, there's a report in 2008 from Alternatives, which actually one of the more left wing Canadian non government organizations, and they have a report in 2008 where they basically explicitly say that the Haitians are too stupid to know what's good for themselves unless they've been trained by a foreign NGO, and that, you know, the political capacities of Haitians are such. So the premise of most of the so-called development work is a premise of we know what's best for you, which is, I think, very problematic.
You just saved me asking, is Alternatives one of those? I was like, right. Yeah, those people are something. Why, in the media coverage that's been occurring in Canada of our role in Haiti, there's a whole lot of will to show scary things. Do you know what I mean? There's never really, they never show a slice of life. They never talk to a Haitian. Well, they might, do you know what I mean? Literally have Patrick Elion or something like that, but never normal people and stuff like that. Do you think this is part of a policy, or do you think this is part of a media culture that kind of creates this separation in culture where really there is not a giant one between Canada and Haiti. They're both clearly westernized, do you know what I mean, nations. The media image is basically of like voodoo practicing, baby eating cannibals. How has that come to be, that understanding in Canada's eyes? And how does that feed into our kind of, oh, those poor people, look how screwed they are?
Well, I think that comes to be through a whole history of imperialism needing it, in the sense that if you're going to dominate a place, you need to justify that domination, and that, you know, in the case of Haiti, I mean, certainly 100 years of U.S. domination of Haiti has engendered credible stereotypes and ideas about. I think as one National Geographic horde of naked niggers back in the U.S. occupation of 1915 referred to Haitians in that way. And so it's really, there's it's a less crass today, but there is still that a lot of that premise. And I don't think it's some sort of like official media policy where all journalists are told to do as such. I think that they get their talking points from the embassy. They get their talking points from the other dominant media, and so it's a constant and
career kicks in over creativity.
Yeah, and career kicks in over creativity. And there's look at the CBC's reporter, that Connie Watson, the CBC radio that they keep sending to Haiti. I mean, she, you know, this is somebody, you don't get to the position of being the CBC's operator in Latin America without sort of having shown your ideological bent to those higher ups.
Being acceptable to the people that are paying your.
Exactly. Yeah. So likewise, you see who gets sent down usually by the different newspapers. Now, having said that, there is some opening within that. So, for instance, Sue Montgomery of the Montreal Gazette, who back in the 2004 coup did some very, very bad, troublesome reporting. She actually came around with the Haiti Action Montreal and the Canada Haiti Action Network, sort of sending her stuff and openly criticizing her and sort of basically putting pressure on her. She started researching in a more serious way and has actually went to the point of actually writing a piece that was basically apologizing for what she had done previously and
explaining her misunderstanding.
Yes, so there is some room to maneuver within that, but the power structures of the dominant media and the what's being pushed and sort of the degree to which journalists have that independence is not that significant.
The MINUSTAH is the United Nations Mission for Stabilization in Haiti. Canada has been part of it. I don't know if we're on active military rotation right now, if there's actually armed Canadians with MINUSTAH
on the, I believe it's on the ground in Haiti.
Yeah, it's negligible if there's, but it's rotation. You know, they'll increase and they'll decrease. There is definitely, I can attest to it, having been scared right shitless myself by people waving guns in my face that were just kids. There is a security problem in the country, definitely. That security is needed. It seems that because of traditional corruption, distrust, and tribalism, basically, that the resources to do that don't exist in Haiti. How should that security be maintained? And also, what should our policy be there in order to support the Haitians in achieving a proper, autonomous, sustainable existence?
Well, I think the first thing is that as much as possible, the security situation should be dealt with by dealing with the sort of underlying causes of the insecurity. So, the different poverty and the destructive nature of the slum life. For instance.
Oh, there's no describing the slums in Haiti.
So that's the overwhelming way. But the next part to it is that. Just to go back in some history, the Aristide government was trying some reform. They had abolished the Haitian army back in the mid-90s, and that was a Haitian army created by the Americans during their occupation of 1915 to 34, and it was an army that was only ever used to repress the domestic population. And so it was seen as just an enemy of the people, and it was seen as a tool of the elite. And so the Aristide government abolished that and then tried to build a policing apparatus. Well, what was the response of the Americans, for instance, was to block to have a ban on weapon sales to the Haitian police. That was a ban that was removed once the elected government was pushed out of power. So while there was an attempt to, and you know, again, this was a very corrupt and questionable police force that was in place during the time of the Aristide government, but there was at least some attempts to get some sense over the matter. And at that point, the Canadian government was hostile to those attempts to, you know, reform at the point where...
For ideological reasons.
For ideological reasons, because they didn't like the government. And they didn't want the government to, you know, be either everything from being successful to having a security apparatus that could, you know, defend it. So that was policy of undermining that. And you know, once the coup takes place, there's this massive increase in Canadian aid to the security apparatus. And this is at a time when the former military are being reincorporated into the police apparatus, at a time when those police are going into the slum neighborhoods and killing people who are demanding the return of the ousted government. So in that context, with that recent history, I actually don't believe that the Canadian state, without, you know, an open and public admission of apology for what they have done in recent years, I don't see Canadian money into the policing security apparatus in Haiti being anything but serving the repressive nature of the state, serving the Haitian elite, and there has to be a whole change in dynamic. And until that happens, you just get more of the same kind of thing.
And what does a productive Canadian foreign policy towards Haiti look like?
Well, unfortunately, in the short term, I think it just looks like less bad, because there has been so much bad over the past 7 years. Longer term, I think. There's, you know, Canada is a country with immense wealth and capacities, and there is potential for, you know, so for instance, the Cuban government has been training Haitian doctors to go work in poor neighborhoods, and that's part of the deal with them going trained in Havana, then they go back to the rural areas. Well, that kind of thing could exists in Canada. There's no reason why the Canadian government could start a project of that nature. I think that the aid policy does need to be oriented more towards supporting the social policy of the Haitian government than the non-government organizations. So the Canadian government is prepared to support the repressive apparatus of the Haitian state, but is not prepared to support the education and the sanitation and the like. And they what they do support on that level is via the NGOs, which is ultimately contributes to the weakness of the Haitian state. So that to shift a lot of the aid money towards the actual government. And also, just a simple one, you know, in the upcoming context, is that the Canadian government should not be funding elections in Haiti when the most popular political party, Famille Lavalas, is not allowed to participate, which is what they just did. Mm-hmm. And so it's no surprise that that there's continued political instability when there's, you know, it goes from one illegitimate government to the next, all financed by Canadian and American taxpayers.